And once again, we will welcome our guests. And Kitty, I'll let you lead off now that your spokesperson is here.
Let me lead off.
Representative Mona Sanderson, good morning.
Good morning. I have been a representative of the Oregon Commission for Child Care during the interim when in between special sessions. And it is, what the recommendations that have come out of this committee are extremely important, and I hope that we will be able this legislative session to incorporate the recommendations. If you want a summary, you just go to the back page of the report, I think that each one of you have received. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because I have the other members of this task force that will speak more eloquently than I. But I do think that child care is an extremely important issue. We have no idea what kind of quality child care we have. We have no way to measure, and I think that's part of the recommendations. And there are certainly important things that we need to address so that our children who are being given child care are receiving adequate care so that they can become good, productive citizens. And I'll turn this over now to former Representative Kitty Piercy.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kitty Piercy. I live in Eugene, Oregon, and I am the current chair of the Oregon Commission for Child Care. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for this opportunity to present the findings of the Child Care Financing Task Force to you this morning. I also want to thank the legislature in general for having put out this mandate to get this, put out the bill to get this information that we're presenting to you today. It is very important, and we had a wonderful task force that was made up of about 30, if you look on, probably all of you have this in front of you, the task force report. Just to give you a sense of the breadth of, if anybody doesn't, I'm sure.
Rick,
okay. Yeah. Just to give you a sense of the breadth of the participants on the task force, if you just look inside the first page, you will see a big long list of people. Often when you have a task force and you see a big long list of people, you think maybe how many of those people actually came to participate? Well, what I want you to know is all these people came to participate, and all of them stayed to participate. And there are people from Health and Human Services, there are physicians, there are people from education, there are people from child care, there are people from mental health, there are people from the business community. It is a broad group of people that participated in the task force, and it was a remarkably wonderful experience for all of us. The task force was asked to do four things. We were asked to gather information about the availability of quality child care in this state. We were asked to develop recommendations about how quality child care should fit within the voluntary statewide early childhood system. We were, and there are several people on this committee who have spent an incredible amount of time working on that voluntary early childhood 555 system. We have were asked to develop recommendations on long-term planning to provide quality child care statewide as driven by local community needs, and we were asked to develop recommendations about how to provide financial support for quality child care. Those legislative mandates are on page 4 of the report in case you want to refer to them. And the House bill that they were part of was House Bill 3659. Thing that I wanted to spend a few minutes talking with you about this morning is why quality child care matters. Because if you look at what you asked us to do, you wanted us to tell you how much, not just how much child care is available in the state, but how much quality child care is available in the state. And the reason that you wanted us to answer that question, I believe, is because you know that the vast majority of children spend in our state spend at least part of their lives in child care. And they spend part of their lives at a very important time in their lives when they're young, their brains are developing, and they're setting patterns for their future. So it's of great public interest to us to know what's going on with children in those early ages. And some of you here have been exposed to, if not all of you, have been exposed to the brain studies that have been done around young children that shows how their brains develop when they're very young, and if they're in unstimulating environments, what doesn't happen, and if they're in stimulating environments where they're encouraged to learn, the good effect that has on their brains. And, of course, we're concerned about those brains because that's what prepares them for school and makes them succeed in the future. So neuroscience has revealed that a child's early years are crucial for normal physiological, emotional, sociological, and psychological growth and development. So it's very, very important. And I think many of you have already acknowledged that because you've been involved in early childhood prevention programs like Healthy Start or Relief Nurseries, because you understand that what happens to young children is so important. And we want to bring to your attention that we think that people haven't been paying enough attention to where most of our children are and where we have a real opportunity to make a difference in their lives. Second to parents, probably the place that most kids are spending their early childhood years are in child care. And what happens there or doesn't happen there is very, very important to their positive growth and development. And has a lot to do with our economic prosperity, too. And, of course, with all of our budget concerns and our trying to look out into the future, we all have to be concerned that we are trying to create an atmosphere where parents can go to work and know that their children are in safe and nurturing and developmentally appropriate situations, and that we also want to know that our kids are getting what they need to be prepared for school so they can succeed in school and become good citizens out into the future. So the report goes on to talk about that child care is, although fundamental in the lives of most families, very hard for parents to even know whether their children are in a quality child care situation, because we really don't have a way of identifying how much quality child care we have right now in Oregon. And you will see some of the recommendations that come out of this report to deal with that. Also want to speak to the fact that I think a lot of you are very aware that that child care providers in this state in general, well, child care comes in many different settings. It comes in center settings. It comes in family child care settings. It comes in relative care settings. It comes in many different places. And that in the case of paid child care, child care providers in general make so little money that they don't stay in the profession very long. They'll go somewhere else where they can make a living wage. And when the neuroscientists and people who have studied what happens with children's brains in their early years, their findings show that it really is not in a child's best interest to be constantly going from one child care provider to another, to have a lot of disruption and people who are not equipped to really understand the development of young children. So we want good providers, and we'll keep them more if, in fact, we can pay them better wages. So that's in the public's interest, and that's in the interest of business, because every time a family, a worker, has to find new child care for his or her child, it means time off from work. So a lot of the business community really recognizes the importance of child care in their lives, too. And one of the things that we feel in this state, as we've begun to build a system, early childhood system of care, is that not enough attention has been paid to child care in that system, and we're going to talk about that today. So in a time when we have tight budget constraints and need to make the best use of our dollars, in a time when we want to guarantee our children the best success they can have in the future, it's very important for the legislature to pay attention to child care in the state of Oregon. And this morning, I've given you a brief introduction to the report, and Craig Campbell is here to talk about our recommendations for integrating childcare into the planning for early childhood in the whole state. And Craig?
Sure. I'm going to start by telling you, I am an individual who is extremely fortunate. I happen to work in a small business of four individuals, and my boss wants to make sure that my children, his grandchildren, grow up as well as possible.
Craig, excuse me, would you identify yourself?
Yes, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm chair of the State Commission on Children and Families.
Thank you.
Over the last 3 weeks, I've spent about 8 hours of work time out of the office in medical visits. Now, it's not necessary because I'm also fortunate enough to have a spouse who wanted to be a stay-at-home mom, and so she takes care of the children and could have gone on her own to the doctor's office, but my employer thought it was important to make sure that as a father I was present as well. Now, if you can think of very many small businesses with four employees who can allow to have one of their employees out 8 hours over a 3-week period of time at medical visits, I think you'd be surprised if you could find any. I'm fortunate because my wife's at home, but if either my wife was a single parent or both of us had to work, that means that that business would have to have that person out of the office, lose productivity, and so forth. So childcare has an impact on the business community. You'll note that the childcare division is within the employment department. It was put there for a reason, and that's because of the close connection between childcare and employment. Unfortunately, what's happened is there over time has been something of a disconnect between childcare and the human services system. As you may know, we've done tremendous work over the last 10 years in integrating the social service early childhood system through some pretty comprehensive planning at the local level. We've involved the Commission on Children and Families, we've involved the Department of Human Services and the Department of Education in that task. What we haven't done is brought in the employment department. And because of that link with childcare, even though there are a number of local commissions and local providers who understand the importance of bolstering childcare at the local level, there still isn't that direct integration with the Department of Employment. And so what needs to happen is we need to find a way to make sure that those who are making the decisions around childcare at the state level are as integrated in that process at the local level so that we match up the human services need with the employment need. Now, the human services need around childcare is pretty substantial. If you can imagine how many hours a child spends in childcare as opposed to how much quality time they spend with their parents, you need to make sure that what is being provided to those children results in those children having the best chance of becoming productive citizens in the future, which again, of course, turns back to the employment division. If you have children who are having childcare settings that are not high quality, that are resulting in some problems for those children, two groups are going to be impacted by that. The system of services that will have to support those children because they have problems as they grow up, and the employment sector will not be able to turn to employees who have the skills and the resources necessary to do good work in the future. So for those two reasons, it was very critical that we find a way to integrate that process. You'll see on page 13 some specific recommendations how to integrate those things. Of course, adding quality child care and high quality child care as a definition is critical. Bringing the employment department is one of the agencies that has to coordinate comprehensive planning so that they're directly involved in that. That, quite frankly, is going to help both systems. The human services system often has a tough time breaking out of its human services viewpoint, and the employment section has a tough time breaking into the human services system. They don't see the eye to eye very often, but both are very critical to each other. There's also going to be some specific references between how the Commission on Children and Families will begin to relate with the Child Care Commission specifically and the Employment Department specifically, the Child Care Division, and that's over on page 14. We have had informal relationships, and we've had at times overlapping responsibilities, but only recently have we made a concerted effort to try and integrate those discussions. So those responsibilities and requirements are identified on number 14, and we'll be pursuing with those as we go through the session. It's obviously a difficult time when you have an economic recession on your hands to start talking about looking at a system, the reform of which can be very expensive. But again, as with all early childhood issues, the more you do up front, the less it will cost you in the long run. So I'm confident it's going to be a good investment, not only for our human services burden, but also for our employment needs in this state, and if ever there was a time to provide additional help to our employment sector, now's the time.
Ms. Chairman.
I'd like to take you for a moment back to page...
Just a moment, please. Representative Cruz.
Craig, I've questioned, I'm not sure how long ago it was that employment was separated out from DHS, 10 years ago, something like that? Probably 10 years ago. And as we've looked at the evolution, we've got jobs in AFS, and so, I mean, you almost make it sound like to some degree we have created more problems by that separation than we have solved.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, I wouldn't put it that way. I'd say that we haven't been able to take advantage of as many of the benefits as we could have by moving it into employment. I think the child care relationship of employment is critical, but it did create a divide between the human services system and employment, which I think we need to bring together. Once we do that, I think we'll be in pretty good shape. I do believe that child care needs to be closely tied with employment because it has such an impact on employment.
But I still am wondering if the disconnects that have resulted from that separation, and all things are good, have good intentions and there need to be focus, and maybe there does, but if we're back to a position now of trying to integrate these agencies, the best way to do it would be to combine them again, I think. So something worth considering.
I was remiss a few moments earlier by not noting that we have been joined by Representative Worth. Welcome and good morning. Ms. Pearson.
Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, I'd like to take you back to page 10, and I had talked at the very beginning about the need to be able to measure quality so that we know how much quality we have in this state. That's sort of fundamental to everything else. I'd like to walk you through those recommendations. And what we've got as recommendation one is to establish a child care quality measurement system. We have a research, what do we call it?
Roundtable.
A research roundtable that has worked on a lot of this issue, and we are also talking about trying to work with some foundations to get some funding to support this research, because until we're able to really set up a measurement system and really look at what we've got in child care, it's pretty difficult for us to know what we've actually got. So that's sort of a fundamental, is establishing a child care quality measurement system. And then you will note underneath that that we would research partners will develop and pilot the measurement and reporting of indicators of quality in child care arrangements for use so that parents can use it, employers can use it, and other decision makers. Seems very, very important. And then on the basis of the pilot, implement a statewide system for measuring and reporting quality levels to parents, employers, and other decision makers using strategies such as a STAR system or reports of quality indicators. So we need to know, we need to set up a system where we can measure, then we need to measure, and then you need to, then we can let people know what we've got out here. And we also suggested that the Oregon Progress Board adopt a quality child care benchmark. Right now, the Progress Board only says how much child care we, how many slots are available, and whether and how affordable it is, but it doesn't even mention that we have as a goal not just child care but quality child care. So those, the second recommendation would be, and I think you would all approve of that, that we use solid data on child care to drive the planning process for child care investments. So we need to get the data, and then we need to use the data. And then how are we going to move forward to plan and be able to finance child care in this state?
Can I ask a question? Senator Morstead.
Yes.
George Dunford is going to be with us later in the day, and there was a bill passed last session, I think the number that requires that performance indicators be included in current budget proposals now. And the Progress Board is involved in that. So is this going to, how is that going to impact any budgets and funding that we're currently doing? Because you don't have those measurable quality. That's going to be very difficult to come up with this quality measure. Are you going to have a funding problem this time?
We are not, Mr. Senator Morissette and members of the committee, we are not going to be asking for any budgetary hikes this session. We understand the difficulty of states, and we have recommendations that are non-budgetary for us for consideration. And in terms of the money that's now in the, and I'm going to look to my colleagues to add information to this, but the money that is currently invested in childcare in the state is money that we got to get through federal funding. We don't have any general fund dollars, and have some.
I don't know how much left now. It has been a mix of federal and.
I'm sorry, you'll have to identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm Bobby Weber from the Oregon Child Care Research Partnership.
I'm looking to Tom Olson from the Child Care Division for that answer. What Tom Olson from the Child Care Division said was that we have $4 million in general fund, and in the last special session, we lost $2 million of it. And quality indicators, one of the things that you should probably know is that in terms of this measurement is there are quality indicators that can be used to evaluate the quality of child care. And I'm going to let Bobby Weber, who's much more of an authority on that than I am, would you tell him a little bit about what that means?
Did you get my identification?
We did. It's not necessary to do it again.
Okay. Research has shown that when certain characteristics are present in a child care arrangement, that children's language abilities, their cognitive skills, their ability to interact with other children are higher. And so those indicators can be measured, and that's what we would be piloting, is to actually measure the input that research has shown when they're present, then children do better.
Great.
Thank you. Okay. And now, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Bobby Weber is going to be talking to you a little bit about the recommendations that have to do with the financing of a high-quality child care system in Oregon.
Any questions?
Just a moment, Ms. Weber, Representative Bates.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. You referred to research that shows what those indicators are, what those outcomes are.
Yes.
Could you potentially make that available for me to review later on?
Yes.
Thank you. And I have a question for Mr. Campbell. Just real quickly, you spent 8 hours last week in a doctor's office?
Yes.
Was that in one visit waiting, or was
No. Unfortunately not. It was more very quick, very tentative.
Thank you.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I was wondering how compliant his employer would have been if we were actually in session at the time, but that's...
I would not have been present at those meetings.
Ms. Weber, I think you can proceed now.
It seemed like we needed to do three things. Was to address how financing relates to child care quality, how the current system is financed, and the extent to which the current financing produces the desired quality and child outcomes. So let's start with how we finance child care in Oregon right now. Families do it. 67% of the money spent in child care, and child care is a term we use for all of those non-parental kinds of arrangements that families make. Sometimes it goes under the name child care, but often it goes under names such as Head Start, preschool, nursery school. There must be 15, 20 terms that are used, and we're talking about it broadly to include all of those. We divided out the government expenditures into program expenditures and tax expenditures, because in child care, as you can see, a significant investment is made through tax expenditures, through tax credits, child care tax credits, dependent tax credits. We have a list that will be in the final report that shows what all the tax credits are, Oregon and federal ones that apply to Oregonians, and how much money each of them is being invested in families, but through the tax system. And then program expenditures, those are predominantly child care and development fund dollars that come from the federal government. Also includes Head Start and Oregon Pre-Kindergarten. But the big money is in the voucher program that low-income families who are in employment readiness or employment activities receive a voucher with which they can purchase child care. Business and philanthropy is a small player nationally and also in Oregon. That's the only number in there that's really an estimate, and we used a national figure. The rest are actual numbers for the most current year available. Now, just for contrast, I'm going to show you how we fund higher ed in the United States. And if you can see, it's a much more diverse funding picture. And tuition, which is only 18% of the cost, is really still not all families, because grants, scholarships, all come into that 18%. So we're not asking families to pay anywhere near the burden. And at that point in a family's life, they're much more able to bear the burden than they are in the early years, when parents are typically at their lowest earning power that they will ever have. And so that was just a contrast. Now let's talk about how child care quality benefits children. As I said in response to the earlier, that the higher quality is shown as directly related to positive child outcomes and school readiness. The most child care in the United States is low. 10 to 20% of it, the studies show, is really harmful to children. It's poor. It's not even safe. It's not in any way good for children. The majority of care comes up in rankings mediocre. Poor, fine, fine is a common word used. It's not going to really promote children's development, but they're not in any in direct harm's way. Children who experience the lowest quality care come from the poorest and most stressed families. And also the research shows that high quality care has the biggest impact on children who are at risk. So all children's outcomes are enhanced by high quality care. For low income children, the amount of improvement is much greater. In Oregon, for some relevant Oregon statistics, Oregon child care costs, the prices exceed tuition in public colleges and universities. It's more expensive to put your child into a child care center than it is to put them into one of our colleges and universities. We measure in the population survey every 2 years. Child care is not affordable for 65% of Oregon families who earn below the median income. As families' incomes go up, it becomes more affordable. But it's up to a quarter of the income of low-income families is being spent on child care. And the Oregon child care subsidy, at the rate that we are currently funding those, the value of the voucher that low-income families can take and purchase child care with, in 2000, the value of that voucher would buy only a third of the child care slots in the community. We're just about ready to release the 2002 study, in which that has drastically gone down in the last 2 years. It's even lower. Economists talk about child care as an example of market failure, and there are three different ways they look at that. Most parents cannot afford quality child care, either with their resources at the time, nor do they have the borrowing power to even loan against their children's future employability to pay for the cost. Information problem, Kitty referred to this. There's, in the United States, the polling shows that very few people realize the importance of quality childcare and how directly it's related to child outcomes. And then for parents, there's an additional factor in that it's hard for them to see what they're buying. They see childcare when they drop off the child and when they pick up the child, but they could really use some help in being able to identify the indicators of quality for their arrangement. And the third is that families aren't the only people who benefit from the consequences of childcare. They're not the only ones who lose either. And that the lack of support to quality childcare affects not only the children and their families, it clearly affects the public school system, employers, and communities. We all pay. So what we're looking for is a diverse funding system closer to what higher ed has that does involve parents, and because they are major stakeholders, but also in a larger role, other stakeholders such as employers, communities themselves, the philanthropic center, sector, and local government, as well as state government and the federal government. So the task force actually had some specific recommendations that you've got in your report. The one that has been referred to several times is help parents make good decisions about quality child care. Just give them information. Give communities information so that they can direct their investment in ways that make a difference. Explore the full use of existing funding streams to improve the quality of child care. There are streams that can be directed toward child care that are not currently being used that way in Oregon. We could to explore that. Explore the creation of new revenue streams to pilot new ways of financing child care. I guess the city of Portland and Multnomah County have shown us, the children's levy as an example of a local new financing. Improve the ability of low-income families to afford quality child care, and that's specifically to get the federal government, when they gave the states the Child Care and Development Fund, intended that families would have access to 75% of the slots in the community, and Oregon now is down to below a third. And so clearly families in Oregon who are being helped with the voucher do not have access to the child care supply.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, could I ask a couple questions on this slide?
On the one that just have her put back the one.
Go back one. Thank you very much. Number one, first question, what existing funding streams, are there specific ones that you have in mind?
For exploring the use of existing funding streams?
For example, are you looking at CHIP? What are you looking at here?
They're listed in your report.
Oh, they are.
And
okay.
Let me get the page for you.
That's what you get when you go up.
It says explore. The task force had a significant amount of discussion about the lack of wisdom of raiding anybody else's pots of money. So if you'll notice, the recommendation came out as explore. Title I funds are designated, I'm on page 17.
Okay.
Title I funds specifically state that they can be spent on early childhood, and very little of that is happening in Oregon. So one of the recommendations is to work with the Department of Education and explore the feasibility of some of that being invested in early care and education. Community Reinvestment Act, Bank Act funds can be used and are used in some states to invest in child care facilities and loan programs.
I guess the question is more, are you looking at redirecting funds that are being already invested one way or another, or access to funds that are not being tapped?
We were really talking about when new monies came through those funding streams that we already had developed partnerships so that people who were receiving those funds were thinking about investing those new dollars into early care and education.
Okay. And the other question, I forget what the other question was. Never mind, I'll come back to you. Thank you.
Representative, are you done? Representative.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things we've been looking at for several years now is federal funding streams that we are not taking full advantage of. Okay. I guess when you look at Title I, I think the Department of Education is spending that now, and so certainly this might qualify for that, but what are we giving up to do that sort of thing? And that becomes problematic where as you look at, and CHIPS, the first thing that comes to mind, the fact that we are not fully utilizing all of our CHIP dollars, I mean, that's kind of found money in an existing funding stream if we can find a way to make the match. So
Title I is being increased at the federal level under the Bush administration.
And I understand
what we were
that,
talking
but I'm
about was the new money, not okay. existing.
And I would be surprised if the Department of Education, knowing that money has been increased, hasn't already made plans to spend it. So,
Mr. Chair, could I add something to that?
Yeah,
certainly.
There was a summit recently where the Department of Education, in conjunction with the Child Care Division and the Oregon Commission for Children and Families, looked at how they could join together to do more about child care. And in particular, they were looking at with the mental health issues and how they can be identified and worked with in the child care setting and how that's in the interest of preparing kids for school and success. So there's already that kind of looking together at education and child care as a collaboration that needs to start very, very early. And the other thing I wanted to bring to your attention on page 17 in that same section talked about identifying, removing barriers to full usage of existing child care tax credits. One of the members of the committee was from the Association of Oregon Industries, and she asked her members if they were fully utilizing the tax credits, and they weren't. And so we have a lot of work we can do to improve what's already out there, and I just wanted to point that out to you, too.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple questions on the funding part. I have some other questions, but I'll save them until the very end, right? Two things. One is I've been investigating sources of revenue because I've been really interested in community learning centers and family resource centers, and a lot of those provide after-school care and child care, you know, in a school-based setting. And it seems like other states have maximized some revenue sources to do this, that Oregon has not. TANF is one source that I see a lot in the federal documentation. It seems like in Oregon we have used TANF in other ways in our state. Do you have any comments on that and some of the sources that other states use that Oregon is not using for child care?
TANF is the largest.
Uh-huh.
Other states, when they had TANF surplus, a lot of that money went into early care and education. Sometimes up to, I'd have to look, but up to 30% of the money they were spending on child care was coming from TANF expenditures. That's the biggest one that I know of that we've invested that money elsewhere.
Right.
I'm not aware. States use lots of strategies to fund. They tax themselves. I mean, Florida just put in this last election, Florida just put in public pre-kindergartens for 3- and 4-year-olds. That's joining in, I think now maybe, I'd have to look, maybe 10 states that are doing that. But that's tax dollars that there are sometimes more philanthropic and more business involvement than we happen to have in Oregon.
Okay. I have one other follow-up, Mr. Chair. And that is on the Child Care and Development Block Grant, which I know that Employment Department gets some for the resource and referrals, right? And the Department of Human Services does the employment-related daycare with their part, and then the State Commission on Children and Families gets the 18-point-whatever percent for expanding the supply and capacity of childcare providers. I was involved with the State Commission on Children and Families as a staff person when that money first hit, and it seems like we haven't really done any sort of a looking back to see how well that's working with the three separate agencies administering it, how the counties are actually using the money at the local level. I know there's been some adjustments in the administrative rules on the State Commission side, but there hasn't been a lot of technical assistance at the local level in that regard. Did the committee talk about, was there an analysis about how well the current dollars are being used in the system right now, and whether there are ways to target those dollars in a more systemic way to get to some of the goals that you've outlined in your report? And could that be part of it?
The committee looked at how the dollars were currently being spent. We didn't go in and do any evaluation. It's my understanding, though, that the Child Care Division and the Commission on Children and Family are directly involved in evaluating how the commission spends its money. And all of those, all of the Child Care and Development Fund expenditures are under, I should make it available. We've created performance measures for the child care system in the state of Oregon, and we are monitoring progress on all aspects of, or key aspects of child care, and it certainly includes the performance measures about the vouchers and about the resource and referral system. I don't know if I'm answering your question, Representative Carlson.
I
feel like the accountability systems are pretty strong for the Child Care and Development Fund.
Right. I guess my perception is, and I haven't looked at it closely for several years, is that on a county-by-county basis, counties decide how they're using it. Some use it for services, as long as the services don't compete with the slot requirement that it not be used for slots. But a number of counties were using them for things, you know, like you could get a little grant and you could get a toilet fixed, or you could get play equipment in the backyard. And there was some hassle about, well, if a provider moved to another county, then who took care of the stuff? I mean, there was this great Coos County story about toys being stuck in the county courthouse for weeks and nobody knew how to dispose of them because the provider moved and the county said, we want you, you can't take the toys with you. And, you know, and it just seems to me that, you know, you reach a limit in terms of how many family providers are in a small community, how many dollars they can spend on stuff, and whether or not there's some broader systemic issues that need to be addressed that perhaps we're not getting at in this state by using the money that's where we're using it right now.
I'm wondering, that since I know that the Child Care Division and the Commission for Children and Families have been looking in depth at how the Child Care and Development Fund dollars will be spent by the Commission on Children and Families through the county structure, I would like to be able to have the State Child Care Administrator report back to the committee and be really concrete on what the plan is.
Okay, thank you.
The last
Excuse me, ma'am. Representative Bates.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure this is the right time to ask this question, but I can't think of a better time, so I'll do it now. The problem we face in child care is a result of obviously a huge change in the workforce, and that
yes.
parents aren't home anymore.
Yes.
And that kids spend more time in school now. They spend more time at home watching TV by themselves. And I applaud the work you've done in this report. I read it quickly last night, read through it some more today. A lot of hard work here. One thing that struck me, however, was that in the task force members and in the recommendations, I didn't see any tie into K-12 schools of significance. That's something that has long troubled me in child care. It came up during the last session, and I remember having a meeting at one time where we were talking and we were discussing some of the revenue for K-12, and nobody was there from K-12 and our Department of Education. And while we were talking and discussing maybe moving some money, suddenly they showed up. They were a little breathless, but they got there. And there was a natural sort of, you remember that day, don't you? You remember it very clearly. When I started to touch the money, all of a sudden they were interested in child care outside of K-12. There's been a natural reluctance for the K-12 community not to engage in this debate. The kids come to my classroom and they leave my classroom, and what happens after school or prior to those years coming to school is not part of their discussion, and it should be. And I was a little concerned that was not part here. it seems natural to me, and the programs I've seen in my county that have been set up, that the best place for quality childcare for kids that are already in school is in the school after hours. The programs we've set up in Jackson County have a waiting list for them. Mm-hmm. We have parents changing schools to get into those programs because some schools offer them and some don't. Some schools don't want to get engaged in those offerings because they just feel it's not their responsibility. But we try to encourage them and try to make them think that this is a continuum of care. This is a continuum of education. You can't just think these kids drop into your classroom and drop out later on. The damage to these kids, as far as dropout from high school, as far as health care needs, as far as crime, as far as being successful citizens later, is huge. And I'm very concerned that I don't see this here. I don't see us talking about programs for kids that are 2, 3, and 4 years old inside our K-12 buildings. I don't see full kindergartens being offered. I don't see a discussion here of our primary goal being setting up programs for kids that would be continuous to those parents can pick them up from their jobs. I just don't see it here, and I'm concerned that that is not part of the report. I want to ask you to think about where you go with that. I think that's the best answer for the problem you're looking at. Trying to set up competing departments and competing programs haphazardly across the state when you've got a good K-12 program to piggyback on seems to me a logical solution, or at least a partial solution to this problem. I would ask you to consider that. Thank you.
For the children who are at least kindergarten through, I just totally agree with you. It makes no sense to create solutions elsewhere to move the children. I'm from Corvallis, and we actually almost built a busing program where we were going to train high school kids to be with younger children on the buses to take them to their different arrangements. We've been through about 9 months of planning before we said, why are we moving the children? And we ended up creating a collaborative school-based program that Parks and Rec and the Arts Center and the Boys and Girls Club all work together and create, which is at risk now because of budget cuts, but it has worked for 10 years in providing very high quality in the school. Babies and toddlers, more challenging to think about putting them in K-12 buildings and the cost. And anyway, I think your points are well taken, and that the, you know, for the task, one of our recommendations is that the Commission for Children and Families create an ongoing financing group, and these concepts can be taken to the ongoing group.
The committee would like to recognize and welcome Senator Trowe. Good morning. And Representative Carlson.
Well, I just wanted to tag on with Representative Bates said. I think having sat by him in Ways and Means for the last year indoctrinated him in some of my soapboxes, but that has been one that I've been talking about for a very long time. And in terms of the younger, the toddler piece, Edward Ziegler has books that are coming out of the Yale Bush Center that promote child care in the schools, even for young children, because it's an opportunity for parents to connect with the school from birth instead of waiting to connect with the school at kindergarten. And we had Edward Ziegler, who came here in 1999 and talked about that with both the House and the Senate committees. Representative Cruz was the chair of the committee at the time. So I think that it is something that's really absent from this report, and I would really encourage you to take a look at the research. And I've got the phone numbers and the websites and things if you're interested in the research on that.
Ms. Weber, you may now proceed.
Thank you. We just have four others. Encourage employer-based supports for child care and workforce place flexibility. And I think Craig actually talked a lot about that. How successful a family is in raising healthy children has a lot to do with how well they can manage. And how well they manage has a lot to do with whether they can take children to the doctor, whether they can make it work. And one of our own, Oregon's Arthur Emlin from Portland State University, has done considerable research on the relationship between quality childcare and workplace policies. And engaging businesses and advocating for supportive childcare, we think that is an audience that we have a lot of potential to work closely with. Expanding the resource and childcare resource and referral program's ability to serve employers and families. And then the task force recommends that there be a campaign to actually help Oregonians understand the relationship between what happens to young children in their childcare arrangements and the things that we care about, such as school success or later success in life.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Marchette?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't require attendance at kindergarten, which I think is a mistake. We should do that. I'll try it again.
One quick comment, please.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it's really a little beyond the scope of your report, but one of the things that seems inescapable when you're discussing quality child care is just the low wages that are paid to people that work in this field. And I was shocked to find in pursuing proposals about the minimum wage that we have a lot of people doing child care who are falling below the level that we're increasing the minimum wage to. So, you know, I know that's another money issue, but it really seems like it's just a glaring one.
We're never going to solve the quality problem. We have a turnover of at least 40% a year, and we know that children need consistent caregivers. Why are they turning over? Because the average wage is $6.72 an hour. The ones who leave are being replaced by much less competent people. There's plenty of research to show that who's leaving are educated caregivers, who's entering are people with very low skill levels, education and skill levels. So I absolutely agree. Until we find a way of dealing with compensation, including wages and benefits, we're not going to keep people in this occupation who we want to be the ones who are caring for our children in these critical years.
Mr. Chair, could I make a
yes.
comment? On page 12, we have, relating to your comments, Representative Rosenbaum, we made a couple of suggestions, and one is to use workforce training and compensation mechanisms to develop a child care workforce that is better able to provide quality care, talking about using the Workforce Investment Act to improve training and reduce turnover, to continue outreach to child care workforce on available insurance options. We are doing that now. We're going to continue because a lot of them don't even know what's out there that they can currently utilize. And then we have recommendation four, utilize program and tax expenditures to improve the quality of available child care. And those are the bigger ones, like, you know, people getting paid decent wages for providing that care, and rising the employer tax credit, create a tax credit for members of the child care workforce based on their level within a professional. They get paid more if they have a higher quality of care. We're trying to find lots of small ways to make their lives better. And of course, we have always, when I was in the legislature, we always had a discussion about can we find some way to provide them some benefits when they don't have those. And if we could find some way through the state entity to do that, that would help. Actually, it would be making more wages. So.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Just another follow-up. We had a wonderful presentation at one of our task force meetings regarding this very issue. And if each child care provider was paid a family wage job, it would increase our economy revenues. They have figures, and I don't remember them. But it would solve our budget crisis. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's interesting.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to applaud all the work that you've done here in this report, and as well as the comments from the committee here. But I think that for me, the most glaring omission I see is that, you know, ever since I've been involved in the legislature, any child care resources that exist out there are the first targeted when we look for money. You look at the rebalances. You look at the cuts that were made over the last several months due to our deficit. Child care is the first out there on the firing lines. I mean, look at the reductions in the ERDC, Stanford Children proposal we lost in literally the last day of the session. Oregon pre-K money, gone, gone, absolutely gone. Child care assistance for higher ed, gone. I mean, I'm getting letters and letters and letters and emails from these people who are, you know, saying, why don't you value, you know, school to work as opposed to welfare to work? Why doesn't the legislature value that? And I say, well, I do, but here's a bunch of, you know, addresses, and write to these senators and these representatives. And time and time again, the response I get is, you're looking for a handout. I didn't get help when I had kids to pay for my babysitter. So that, to me, is the huge hurdle that we have to overcome. And I have no idea, because I just got so frustrated last session fighting it. And how do you overcome that? And you guys are by far the experts on all this. And thank God Bobby's mine, because I'll just be looking to you. I mean, I would really, aside from all this incredible work, I mean, how do we get through the doors first with the members of the legislature? And I know that's probably too big of a question to answer right now, but...
Without incriminating yourself.
Representative, I guess this is a good way for me to sort of segue to the end of our presentation, and that is that we are recommending that we all intensify having this conversation not only with legislators but with the public about the importance of child care in the lives of our children and our families, and that at this point, not only don't we know how much quality care we have, at this point we don't even really have a system in place. And what we're before you hear our recommendations for putting a system in place, and even though we can't get all the way there now, we should know where we're going and keep moving in that direction consistently every session after session, year after year.
We have one more question. Senator Flano?
Yeah, I just had a comment. I serve on a bank board, and earlier in your presentation you mentioned something about the Community Investment Act. Mm-hmm. And small banks, especially in Eastern Oregon, always looking how they can comply with those federal regulations. And have you worked at all with the Oregon Bankers Association?
There have been, Senator Clarno, over the years there have been different, Oregon Community Foundation was involved for a while, there have been different attempts to try and engage, and I don't know if the wrong people, we just haven't found anything sustainable, but we did have people on the task force who were much more knowledgeable about what we need to do, because that primarily will help facilities, but facilities is a big barrier for child care.
Well, I just know that lots of banks in many areas struggle with how to meet the requirements of the Community Investment Act, and as we do in our bank. And I just, if I might make a further comment, thank former State Representative Kitty Piercy. Even though I haven't made every meeting, it's obvious to me you've done a tremendous amount of work on this, and I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Fisher.
Yeah, sometimes, and I realize you all done great work and everything, but we spent half the time trying to figure out how to keep two-parent families and keep one parent home taking care of their kids like I think we ought to. We would avoid having to just figure out how in the world we're going to tax the devil out of everybody so that everybody has to work so they can put their kids in child care. You know, we go over literally head over heels over trying to figure out how we can raise wages, how we can do this, how we can tax more and so forth, and burden very people we're trying to help. And frankly, I think sometime we ought to put just as much effort into trying to go back the other way and see if we can encourage people to have two-parent families and encourage one of them to stay home and take care of their family like it's what their responsibility should be. And I know that that's pie in the sky and utopia and a few other Pollyanna and a few other things thrown into it, but we spend very little time on that in comparison to what we spend in the other.
Senator Fisher, one thing that the task force spent a considerable amount of time on was parental leave, paid and parental leave.
Yeah, which rate is the tax which goes ahead and just causes the burden to be more and more and more. Somewhere we've got to get back and strip a lot of this stuff out of the package.
Well, we have a huge percentage of families that can't make it on one. I think I'd be happy to get you the number.
We have a huge amount of families that if you figured it out, that extra person out there working isn't bringing in $100 more than they would if they stayed home. And if we give them $100 to stay home and take care of the business that they ought to, we'd all be ahead of the ballgame. So there's both sides of this coin.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Senator Fisher kind of made my point. It's not necessarily politically correct, but the fact is I read a study about 2 years ago that indicated that if you have both parents working and their combined income is under $30,000, when you add the additional expenses of both parents working, they'd be better off having one parent working. And I think from the perspective of the child, having a full-time parent would be incredibly beneficial. And I don't see any, I've never seen any reference in all this discussion to trying to put something definitive to that. And maybe we should look at ways that we can actually have parents be the caregivers rather than a third party. And I think it's worth exploring.
Representative Cruz and Senator Fisher, there's a new book out by David Blau, an economist. I think it's called The Child Care Problem in Economic Analysis. And he recommends, he ends up recommending a family allowance. It's basically as to achieve the goal of families having a choice to stay home. You know, he's an economist. I finished the book and wondered about the political feasibility in the United States of a family allowance, but it would achieve the goal of giving families
But if we know and if we can demonstrate and we can show to people that overall they're not going to be driving a Lexus and living in a 6,000 square foot home, but at the level of employment they have, they would be better off and their child would be better off if one parent was working and the other staying home. I think that would be beneficial, but I don't think that anybody's being told that out in the public. I think the assumption is we've got to make more money, and they're not looking at all of the ramifications. So,
Ms. Piercy, I believe you may conclude now.
Thank you. I want to tell you how much we appreciate the opportunity to present this report to you, and we did try to answer the questions that we were asked, and the questions that we were asked is how much to find out how much quality care is out there, and we said we don't know, and we need to find out. We were asked to give some suggestions for financing. We tried to bring those forward. We put skeleton together of a long-range plan that we hope you will look at and embrace and support us in. And we have a proposal for how, and it will be an actual legislative proposal that we hope that, actually, if you're interested in, this committee might think about putting forward, which has to do with integrating the planning for child care into the early childhood system that Craig referred to. So we have done our best to, there are some, obviously, some more work that needs to be done, and we didn't dream as big as we could dream, but we try to answer the legislative mandate and to give you a comprehensive, well-thought-out package. Our next thing to do is that this task force was so incredible that we're going to try to keep them going, and in January, the Commission for Child Care has to do its annual report to the governor and to the legislature, and so we are going to go back to this and prioritize and try to begin building those partnerships that we talked about and move child care forward for the state of Oregon, so you'll have a more complete report in January, but we hope this answers what you asked us to do, and we're glad that you asked. Thank you.
We thank you for your hard work and your testimony here today. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Could I have the liberty of going back to our previous testimony here with the folks from the adult foster care providers?
You may.
In the letter that, thank you, Mr. Chair, in the letter from Gary Lane where he refers to the fact that he receives $4,333 per month per service, that is not per resident, that is total for the five residents. It's less than $900, it's $800 and some per resident per month, and not the huge figure that we were kind of toying with the idea he was receiving per month. So I want to put that on record and make sure that we understand that trying to get $50,000 extra out of that kind of money per month is just not there.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. We'll move on to our 11:15 agenda. Mr. David Hartwig will talk about, from DAS, we'll talk about automated external defibrillators. Good morning.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have prepared for you a report that you have in your packet. It's called Report in Response to House Bill 3338. And I'll be going over this for you and taking questions that you might have along the way.
I appreciate.
In 1999, legislature passed Senate Bill 313, which...
Excuse me, would you identify yourself, please?
I'm David Hartwig, Administrator of the Risk Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hartwig, could you speak up? Some of us who are getting older don't hear too well.
All right.
I don't think that amplifies very much, so you're going to have to do it with your voice.
I'll just do it myself, or try to.
Thank you.
In 1999, Senate Bill 313 was passed, which set basic requirements to establish protection from liability for use of automated external defibrillators, AEDs. This bill was codified in statute by ORS 30.801. In 2001, the legislature directed the Department of Administrative Services to study the placement and the use of AEDs in buildings owned, leased, or operated by the state. DAS was also directed to establish criteria in the following areas: selections of buildings to house automated external defibrillators, purchasing and maintaining automated external defibrillators, integrating AEDs with existing emergency medical services and equipment, and finally training building occupants in the use of automated external defibrillators. The last four items are the focus of the report that I'm going to present to you. Just briefly, a little bit of history of the use of AEDs. Department of Labor, Occupational Safety and Health Administration reports that 61 million Americans have cardiovascular disease, resulting in between 300,000 to 400,000 deaths per year from cardiac arrest. Cardiac arrest is a sudden and unexpected loss of heart function. It is most often caused by a chaotic beating of the heart that can be restored to a normal rhythm if treated early with electric shock, defibrillation. The survival rate for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is only 1 to 5%. Witnessed events with immediate defibrillation can result in a greater than 90% rate of survival. Unfortunately, for each minute of delay, nearly 10% fewer individuals survive. Advances in defibrillation technology have resulted in the design and availability of affordable, user-friendly, low-risk machines known as AEDs. AEDs make it possible to provide public access defibrillation that can be delivered by a lay provider with basic training. Oregon OHSU has initiated a study of AEDs, and in 2000, DAS was invited to participate on the effectiveness of AED use and public access defibrillation. DAS then extended the invitation to Oregon state agencies. There were seven sites that volunteered to participate in the study. And OHSU provided public access defibrillation sites and an AED with maintenance, medical director services, and both AED and CPR training. The control sites were giving only CPR training. Unfortunately, the study isn't scheduled to be completed until 2003. So we don't have the benefit of that study for information provided in this report. But we have put together information from other sources, the American Heart Association, the American Red Cross, and Federal Department of Health and Human Resources to put together a recommended criteria for you to consider. On the first selection of preliminary criteria is related to selection of buildings to house AEDs. And we recommend three. The first that we've recommended is that agencies and buildings must be able to recruit a sufficient number of state employee volunteers who are trained to use the AEDs, so at least one volunteer is able to reach a victim's side within 3 minutes of notification of an event. The second would be that agency leadership commit to ongoing support for program administration and training. This includes centralized administrative program oversight, identifying a supervising physician, recruiting and training volunteers, maintenance of equipment, planning for post-event review, post-event counseling, and monitoring and documenting response to events. I think we'd very much benefit from the study that OHSU is working on now and putting together other criteria for that. Now, selecting specific sites, we used information that OHSU has developed in regards to exposure hours, in regards to establishing criteria to select sites. You'll see in your report that it makes a reference to 1.4 million hours of exposure hours. We took a complicated formula that OHS used and determined that we would recommend that public access defibrillation programs in state buildings be considered cited at the three criteria that we've listed for office sites. We recommend that office sites of 850 FTEs be selected for that. For institutions, we recommend that 1,000 residents be in the institution. And for campus sites, we recommend 13,000 daily occupants. In each of these, we have put together the best that we can using OHSU information. An extrapolation of the number of hours of people working there, an estimate of the number of visitors that come through, as well as an estimate of what the number of individuals age 50 and higher might be.
Mr. Chair?
How
many state buildings meet the 850 FTE requirement?
Representative Cruz, information that I have would indicate that there would be four, a public service building, revenue building, Portland State Office building, and a DHS building.
Mr. Chair.
For a small universe.
Is there a defibrillator in the Capitol for use here?
I'm not sure.
I think there is.
Okay.
Senator Carano.
Did you have any discussion about how we address the issue? It's a great report, and I think it's great. You have to go on something, I guess, like population. But here again, how do we address the disparities in rural Oregon? And let me just think of five or six counties that I know where the population might be under 1,200 people. And they're not anywhere going to, I mean, did you have any discussion about how we address those disparities? I mean, we don't have the numbers to warrant the investment, I guess. Are these things very expensive? How expensive are they?
The answer is expense is probably in the eye of the beholder. They're not particularly expensive. Let's see if I can find it here quickly. A two-year lease for an AED, which would include a medical direction and site assessment and all the equipment and training, would be $5,400. In response to your question of how to address rural areas, I think I would suggest that the best way for us to do that would be to take the experience we have from a current study that that OHS is doing that we're participating in. If a decision was made to site them in larger buildings, such as we've recommended, and get some history of the use and experience, and then pass that on to the smaller areas, rural areas, smaller office areas, and go from there. I do a progressive analysis.
And I'm thinking that every county has a sheriff's department, and I guess that I'm thinking that that's at least addresses, looking at something like that, or at least address one in each county, because we're going to have many counties where there won't be one based on this criteria, one at all. And a lot of times when you have 1,200 people in a county, it's not unusual to have it be 1 or 2 hours to physician help, so, or hospitals.
Yes, and again, the focus of this study was state facilities, state employees, so we didn't really look
I understand.
Much beyond that.
It's just one of those discrepancies that and I don't mean to be critical of the work you've done, but it's one of those discrepancies that just further divides our Oregon. So I just want to put it on the record that when we have that, we have problems. But thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morsak.
I'd like to kind of respond to this. We did take a trip 2 years ago through rural Oregon, stopped at 14 health sites, and the emergency responders in some of the rural areas, hopefully, would be the source of that. But I agree, it's inadequate. Mm-hmm. I think that's something we do need to do.
Thank you, Senator. Senator?
Okay. Yes. Thank you. Moving to the second item regarding the purchase and maintenance of AEDs, we recommend that purchases only be made of commercially available AEDs that have been approved for the market by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. We'd recommend that the purchase be in compliance with state purchasing guidelines. We think economies of scale may exist by utilizing DAS state procurement of issuing a statewide price agreement. A lease agreement is also an option I mentioned earlier where you can purchase the equipment, the training, the medical oversight, and data management all with one contract. Because AEDs are prescribed devices, the selection and procurement of them by DAS would best be done under the guidance and written authorization of the program supervising physician. For the current pilot program that is in existence now, each site has a physician who has agreed to provide oversight at that facility. And finally, the criteria regarding maintenance, the agency should maintain and document the operational condition of the AED and support equipment, and the AED should be checked regularly and after each use, according to manufacturer specifications. On the third item involving integration with existing emergency medical services and equipment, we would recommend that each public access defibrillation program meet the immunity requirements of ORS 30.801. I'd mention that the immunity requirements are specific to persons who have been trained or are utilizing the AEDs. It's not specific to organizations in regards to providing protection to organization or employers that would provide that service. The preliminary criteria that we would recommend would be that users be trained in the instruction of CPR and in the use of the AED in a course approved by Health Services, Emergency Medical Services and Systems of the Department of Human Resources, that the local EMS be called when it's emergency medical service be called when an AED is used. Use of AEDs require special documentation. All patient information generated must be collected and secured in a confidential medical file. Copies must be presented to the medical director and the local area EMS program coordinator as soon as possible. At a minimum, event information must include recorded data and all electronic files captured by the AED. A manufacturer's specification on testing and maintenance must be followed. Medical direction and program oversight from a state licensed physician is required. And local EMS should be given the name, address, phone number of the site's program administrator, the program starting date, copy of the written plan, and each AED location. Also, the local EMS should be notified about the quantity and brands of AEDs at the site. This would enhance EMS staff's ability to properly plan and manage the scene in the event of use of an AED. Also, agencies should assure that the public access defibrillation program meets Oregon OSHA requirements, that employers have an emergency action plan appropriate to its operation, described at OAR 437-002-0042, and to provide medical services and first aid according to Administrative Rule 437-002-0161. The availability of an AED should be integrated into the training, posting, protocols, and practices of existing plans and services that agencies have in place. In regards to building occupant training, we recommend the following criteria: that DAS work with an AED manufacturer and supervising physician to identify appropriate training guidelines and select a trainer. Any professional contracting would need to be done in compliance with state purchasing guidelines for professional services. An agency's AED program administrator would coordinate with personnel to assure that there are enough trained state employee volunteers to cover work schedules. That volunteers will need to be trained to recognize cardiac arrests, to access 911, to perform CPR, and to use the AED and its accessories. We'd recommend that on-site training at least once a year and mock drills no less than once every 6 months be done to maintain and improve the skills of the volunteers, and that agencies need to document that protocols regarding AED equipment use, training dates and the names of the volunteers trained, dates and names of persons that receive certification, and track their certification expiration dates and the dates of mock drills. And finally, communicate program procedures to employees. Finally, we would mention that some components that weren't part of the report for your consideration, that DAS write the state policy statement and itemize the program's components, that AED procedures be established and reviewed by the state, that post-event review after each use of an AED occur with a medical director to review and assess the public access defibrillation system's performance, including a review of the AED data, and finally, that post-event counseling be provided by trained professionals in critical incident stress management. With that, I'll conclude.
Thank you, Mr. Hartwig. We might make note, too, the committee recognizes that in the audience we have John Chisholm with the American Heart Association, who also is available should the committee have any questions in regards to this. Are there any questions of Mr. Hartwig or perhaps Mr. Chisholm? Thank you very much. Mr. Chisholm, we thank you for being present today, too.
Thank you.
We shall recess for lunch and reconvene here at 1:05.
Good job, Bill.